Welcome to Redemption, the podcast designed to save the planet. Today, we continue our discussions on the transformative potential of the Packaging and Packaging Waste Regulation, or PPWR. In a previous episode, we took a deep dive into the legislative framework itself, and now we're taking a closer look at how reuse is starting to show its true potential in helping us move toward a more sustainable future. And to find out what that could mean with the PPWR so close to coming into effect. Though reuse has faced significant challenges in terms of implementation, this episode aims to shine a light on some real-world examples that prove the power of reuse. We'll also explore how the PPWR can go beyond its current targets and fully embrace reuse as a central pillar of change. So let's dive right in. Next, I spoke with Natan Dufour, Reuse Systems Manager and the leader of the Reuse Vanguard Project, also known as RSVP, at Zero Waste Europe. Natan, we spoke last time about the PPWR and how the push for reuse targets has been less than satisfactory, with many believing they might be too difficult to achieve. However, I understand you have a couple of examples to share that demonstrate how these systems can successfully take root despite the abundance of single-use options.
There are a few examples of that that are actually encouraging. And yeah, in Germany, you have a city called Tübingen that has been levying a tax on single-use packaging and cutlery for takeaway. And that has been working well.
Already a couple years at least, right?
Exactly. They started 2022. They got sued by a big fast food chain.
Usually that's a sign of smart legislation, right? When a lawsuit, at least in the US anyway.
But the lawsuit was about, you know, is a city actually allowed by the constitution to do such things, right? It seems to be going positively and that actually Tübingen and all the other German cities will be able to do that and continue to do that. Now, the good thing is I'm giving you this anecdote because I think it's an important one. Tübingen had to stop to collect the tax from the HoReCa actors because it was exposing itself too much to penalties and so on if the court case was not going well. But the HoReCa actors kept collecting it from the consumers. So basically for the consumers, it didn't change anything. And it's like the measure was still enforced within the next years. And so now you see, and that's the figure I got recently, is that you have about 50% of the consumers that have shifted to reuse, which is significant, right? The mechanism is working. It shows that with proper support, people are actually grabbing those reusables and interacting with them and changing their habits. So there is a need for a stronger regulatory push, and that's for sure. And another way is maybe to ban single use for takeaway. And that's something we're looking into. Some people are saying, yeah, you're crazy, you will never get there. But actually, I have one example in Europe, which is Luxembourg, that has put that into its legislation. For January 2025 should be enforced. It's a big challenge, obviously, to enforce that. But it tells the world that some people are really willing to move on and that the revolution is picking up.
Yeah, well, I think there's cries that the sky is going to fall, the economy is going to tank if these things happen. And so even if Luxembourg is a small place, it's going to be proof positive that life will go on, everything will be fine. It would be interesting to hear you speak a little bit more about some of the necessary steps and infrastructure required. I mean, beyond just the regulatory framework that we at ReLoop totally agree is a necessary prerequisite. And what are some of the other steps or infrastructure required to scale up reuse systems in urban areas like you've spoken about and really just help make that transition from single use to reusable packaging at a greater scale?
So, yeah, it's a very good question. What we've been doing within the RSVP framework is first, we realized that at some point, initiatives were mushrooming all over Europe. And I think it's the case as well in the US, from what I know. And it was great. And so we were pushing a lot for these initiatives and small businesses actually to really develop their activities, get more visibility and so on. So we wrote case studies about them, about some of them, the most promising ones and so on. But then at some point, we realized that it was becoming a major obstacle as well for the upscaling of reuse systems. And so at some point, we were like, okay, but what would be the solution for that? Well, we need maybe to try harmonize what is being tested. And now the next question, how do you get there? Well, maybe we need some sort of a model, let's call it a blueprint, to try harmonize that around, well, key definitions, and then maybe also some essential criteria. And make sure that the key performance indicators, for instance, are being harmonized over time and so that the legislature could eventually expect a proper reporting from the implementation work and make sure that environmentally speaking, it makes sense. And then it's good for economic actors as well, because economically speaking, they need to monitor and make sure, for instance, that return rate is the good one, that the system performs well, generally speaking. And we want really, by this initiative, to really reconcile the economy with the environment. And I think this is one of the way forward, is basically you embed your business case into proper environmental thinking. And many reuse operators, companies across Europe have been actually doing a great job when it comes to that. So they have such a radical thinking, like they designed the business model based on much more sounder parameters than previous businesses have been doing, like the big businesses now that are struggling to adapt. I'm using struggling because I don't want just to blame them. I think there is really a struggle to adapt the new paradigm we have been pushing for as environmental NGOs, and we need to bridge that gap as well. And so I'm doing a lot in my work to try to do that and try to embolden them as well with that process.
I mean, my first thought there was, wow, how enlightened. But when you stop to think of it, it's actually just good business sense, right? That is a key to survival in a world where we now are facing the realities of climate change. We are facing global pandemics and things that have major impacts to the global economy. So, sure, it may reflect enlightened or progressive thinking, but as you said, it's the alignment of the business objectives with the environmental objectives, not as a means to do some virtue signaling to the sustainability geeks out there or the activist NGOs, but really as a matter of business survival and necessity. And I just think that approach is so critical. And yet, I think European companies are far ahead of US companies in embracing that approach.
I cannot say for sure, but the only thing I can say is when it comes to bridging that gap, as environmental NGOs, we've been doing a lot to update on software in terms of becoming investor friendly, for instance, and stuff like that. Language that not so long ago, like we were not even considering, right? And now we are speaking that language. We've been doing a lot to incorporate all that thinking around key performance indicators. At some point, I remember we even discussed that, like, should we speak that language? KPI, not something very much environmental friendly, is it? And at the end of the day, yes, we need to transform ourselves a bit to really be able to have an impact. But we also want to make sure that businesses are doing the right thing and they acknowledge that they might have a knowledge gap and that we can help them actually bridge that gap. But then we also want them to act in good faith. And unfortunately, it's still too much the case that many businesses are big businesses that are mostly benefiting from the status are just hiding stuff or not playing it fairly, to say it lightly.
Yeah, and I think what we saw with the PPWR and, efforts to derail the reuse targets, I mean, that is routine here in the US. I think in the EU, the way the process played out was probably atypical, at least in terms of previous environmental legislative initiatives. So I think for the American bystander, it's like, okay, well, sure, that's to be expected. And yet, it came in a bit of a shocking way to Europe. And I suspect there'll be more of it, right? These companies are kind of waking up and seeing a marketplace of 500 million people is not insignificant. It means shifting regulations will have very real impact on operations and the necessary investments. I was delighted to speak again with ReLoop CEO and co-founder, Clarissa Murawski. Zooming out momentarily and looking at the PPWR from a 30,000 foot viewpoint, would you say that this set of regulations goes farther, not only farther than what's come before in the EU, but is really emerging as a set of model regulations for packaging and circularity in packaging across the globe?
One of the critical aspects of the regulation is its focus on taxonomy, which is like a system for classifying and naming things, measurement methodology, definitions, incredibly valuable work. A lot of time has gone into this taxonomy. The elements are crucial for many national governments worldwide as they establish their own clear standards and guidelines. So, by providing a structured approach to defining and measuring concepts in packaging and waste management that are there because targets have been set, the regulation, along with sub-level regulations that are still to come, the devil's in the details, but it will really help ensure consistency and accuracy in reporting and compliance. And any national government would be wise to look at this before they start that process on their own, because so much good work has already been done on it. Ambitious policy framework coupled with the strong business support sets a precedent that could influence many global initiatives, like, for example, the plastics treaty negotiations going on right now. By demonstrating a robust commitment to sustainability and collaboration between governments and private sector, I think that Europe and the work that it's done on this regulation can inspire other regions to adopt similar approaches.
Talk a little bit about, briefly, the robust analysis and sort of technical process that went into developing the PPWR. I think one thing that strikes me, and I think would be of interest to our listeners, is just that there is such a robust technical anchor in the PPWR. In other words, there's a really good scientific justification for these targets and guidance that can ensure successful and effective implementation.
Any regulation or directive has to have an impact assessment done before they decide to go forward. So all of the decisions that were made in the PPWR, A, they had an impact assessment, which is like an environmental and an economic full-fledged impact assessment. They did a full set of consultations throughout, I think it was like about 18 months. So there's been a lot of work done. In terms of what I was talking about, taxonomy, it's things like I'm constantly referring people, for example, from America to it to say, don't go and try this yourself. Go and pick up those good definitions, because all that work has been done. And some of the definitions, you have to understand, this is like third generation. So it's not like they got everything right the first time. The definition of recycling got changed a few years ago. It was a fundamental change, but that's why I often refer people to the definitions. There's the methodologies for the calculation of the targets. How do we calculate recycled content? What's in? What's out? Does chemical recycling fit or doesn't it? Or if it does, in what situations? All of those decisions have been made. Some of them are still being made, like on the chemical recycling for non-PET packaging, for example. But as I said, there's a lot of work that's already been done. Another example, you know, we talk about what are the minimum criteria for a good reuse system. That's in the packaging regulation. There is a set of minimum criteria that defines what is a reuse system. It talks about how the system has to operate. There are, as I said, a lot of sub-level regulations now coming. So how do we calculate a separate collection for recycling rate? How do brand owners report? What are the reporting forms going to look like? All of this stuff still needs to be worked out. There's already some stuff in there, but there's still a lot more to do. It's just great technical work that a lot of expertise from many countries, many stakeholders. That's why I think it's critically important that everybody take a look at it that's interested.
Could you talk about reuse and refill as it currently stands under this regulation?
So the new regulation has some really interesting stuff on reuse and refill, and it includes a few components. But let's just start, first of all, with distinguishing the two concepts. So when we talk about reuse in the packaging regulation, as per the definition, it involves consumers returning reusable packaging that doesn't belong to them, that is ultimately the packaging that belongs to a third party, like the brand owner, and that they bring it back for washing and refilling. An example is a milk bottle is returned, I get my deposit back, and then it gets washed and cleaned, and then that's reuse. Refill, on the other hand, involves when a consumer brings their own packaging to be refilled on the spot. As an example, I bring a coffee cup to a coffee shop, it gets refilled, that's refilling. So when we talk about the packaging regulation, there are reuse targets. They are not refill targets. They started as refill targets, but it was agreed that measuring refill is really, really challenging. So they left it at reuse targets, and that includes things like there's targets on beverage packaging, e-commerce packaging, transport packaging, and they all encourage the use of more reusable packaging over single-use alternatives. The refill targets, there are none because they were too difficult to measure, but they do, however, suggest that takeaway establishments, like takeaway restaurants or the takeaway section in a grocery store, what they basically call HoReCa for all intents and purposes, there is a mandate that they must offer customers with the ability to refill their own package from home And they should also, by 2030, offer some refillable packaging to customers. So there is an obligation that they're going to have to tackle there. And I should also say on the reuse, it was an interesting journey. The reuse component, reuse refill, because they were originally lumped together, was by far the most controversial part of this entire exercise. It spurred significant lobbying efforts from, of course, the takeaway sector, but also the single-use packaging suppliers, including those specifically in the paper slash forestry sectors and the plastics industry sectors. These groups were exceedingly active in their efforts to influence the overall ambition in the regulation, and they did draw down that ambition quite a bit from when it was originally tabled in 2022. It has been reported that this has been the most lobbied regulation slash directive in the history of the EU's environmental laws. So that's kind of interesting as well. But I would say that these regulations highlight EU's commitment to reducing waste and promoting sustainable packaging practices. And the reuse targets and the encouraging refill options really will have an impact on reducing the environmental impact of packaging waste. So I think it was great that in the end they were included, even though they did get slashed. It's a very important step for Europe to have done this.
Do you think the regulatory standards in Europe will exceed what will be or what will hopefully be secured in the UN Global Plastics Treaty?
Absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, Europe is probably a global leader on these things. I think California is in the running as well. But in terms of such a huge region, they are heavily leading the way. I don't think that the plastics treaty is going to draw some of this ambition in, but we may see some of the taxonomy for sure, because all that good work has been done.
Thank you for joining us in this continued exploration of the PPWR and the role of reuse within and beyond the legislation. In this episode, we've highlighted how initiatives and forward-thinking strategies are demonstrating the potential of reuse to tackle the plastics crisis effectively. From the innovative policies being trialed in European cities to the obstacles and successes being encountered in the regulatory process, it's clear that reuse must play a bigger role in the future of packaging legislation. While challenges remain, the stories of Tübingen, Luxembourg, and other cities, such as those mentioned in our previous episode on reuse, show us that progress is not only possible, but happening right now. As Natan and Clarissa emphasized today, this is not just about creating more regulations, but about embedding sustainability at the core of business models and creating a system that harmonizes economic viability with environmental responsibility. Don't forget to visit our website for more resources and subscribe to our newsletter for the latest updates. You can also leave a review on Redemption wherever you listen to your podcasts. And remember, working together from a common ground of knowledge, we can move effective initiatives forward.